ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वैषिणी।
We're going to start on verse 24. Even though we've done that, I want to start there and we'll move on to the other spring, verse 24.
Brahmarthanam Brahmahavih, Brahmarthanam Brahmahavih, Brahmatna Brahmanahutam, Brahmatna Brahmanahutam. Brahmaiva tena gantavyam, Brahmakarma samadhina, Brahmakarma samadhina.
This is the famous verse that we're always chanting before eating. And the verses that have led up to this, and now this verse, the few verses that have led up to it, are really talking about the jiva mukta, the person who living is living liberated. The person who is fully recognized, fully gained this knowledge. And for such a person, for the jnani, this is this gives the kind of the mindset of how the jnani sees the experience using the example of a yajna or a ritual, a karma. Okay? Karma means a ritual, a yajna. Okay? So, for this verse, the verse goes, Brahma Arpanam. Brahma Arpanam, I'll do the Sandhi. Brahma Arpanam, Brahma Havihi, Brahma Agnau, Brahma Na Hutam, Brahma Eva, Brahma Eva, Tena Gantavyam, Brahma Karma Samadhina. So, in, I'd say, a fire ritual, the arpana is the spoon or the mantra that will accompany the spoon. The ladle can be the arpanam, or it can be the special mantra. So Brahman, the arpana, the ladle, which is used to make the offering of the havis, to make the offering, or the mantra that is used to make the offering, either way. So Brahman is the arpanam. Brahman is the ladle. Brahma Havihi. Brahman is the offering itself. It's the ladle, the instrument that you use to make the offering. It's the object, it's the thing that you offer. It's the Havis. Brahma Agnau. Into the fire, which is Brahman. The fire, the Havis, the offering, is offered into the fire. That fire, which is into which it's offering, offered, that also is Brahman. Brahma Agnau. Okay? Brahmana Hutam. And it, that Havis, is Hutam. It is offered by Brahman. So Brahman is the ladle. Brahman is the Havis, which is offering. Brahman is the one who offers, right? And Brahman is the fire, right, into which the Havis is offered. Okay? So Brahman is the whole. Brahmaiva tena gantavyam. Brahman alone is reached, is gained by that person. Brahma karma samadhina, tena, by that one. Brahma karma samadhina, instrumental, going along with the tena. By that one, for whom, whose mind is absorbed. Samadhi means their mind is totally, sees this wholly, completely. Samadhi. Right, it's totally resolved into this. Into what? That the karma, the ritual in its entirety, the entire karma, is Brahman. Every part of the karma, absolutely everything that's involved in the karma, the subject, the object, the location, the instrument of the action, all are equally Brahman. I am Brahman, The ladle I'm using to offer is Brahman. The offering is Brahman. The fire into which I'm doing the offering is Brahman. And the result that I get from the karma, from doing the karma, that also is Brahman. So for the jnani, there is nothing that is not Brahman. The subject, both subject and object, are Brahman. And so now they're using a ritual where a karma, and karma means an action, but karma is the word for a ritual. So in a ritual, if you think about it, a ritual is also called a yajna, right? So in a ritual, what is being done is that you are, as the jiva, right, you are offering some things to the Lord, right? You're doing, offering something to the Lord. You're putting it into the fire, which the fire then takes it up to the Lord. You're offering it for a given result, right? That's what, as a mamukshu, the result is going to be praying for antakarana shuddhi, but for us, I'm sorry, for anybody, the result that you're making an offering into the fire, right, in order to get a karma pala, some sort of a result from that. And that makes it the karma. So this karma, this ritual, can stand for any activity, right? In any activity, and Swamiji will do a long exposition on this, and I'll do a little bit of it. In the Sanskrit, you know, you have all of these, what we call vibhaktis, all of these different cases, and all of the cases, except for the genitive case, rotate around the verb. The verb is the action. Here, in this case, the action is the offering, right? The offering of the havis into the fire. So the offering itself, the juhoti, he or she offers. That's the verb. That verb needs a subject, right? Somebody has to do the offering. So we've got the subject. That's the nominative case. It's called the karta. Then we have the karma. The thing that, now it's all the circling around the verb, right? So now, what is being offered? That's the havis. Okay? How is it being offered? With the ladle. That's the karana. That's the instrumental. So now we've got the karata, the subject, the karma, the object, the karana, the object. The dative case would be for the sake of whom? For whom? For what purpose? The ablative case would be the cause, because of what reason, or from which place, right? And the locative case here is being represented into the fire. Right? That's, so all of these things rotate around. They support the verb. Right? And then there's one genitive case that is going to be related to the objects, not to the verb. Right? And so now, when we do an analysis of subject-object, who is the self here? Who is the self? Who are you in all of this? Initially, you're going to say, I'm the subject. Right? I am the subject. I am the karta who is doing. I am the karta, the doer, who is doing the action, you know, upon a given object. And all of these other karanas, all of these other relationships to the verb will come in. But what has to happen to me in terms of my vision? It's not just that I see myself now for jnani as I am both the subject and the object. That's right, if I see that I am both the subject and the object. Because as a jnani, what has to happen is that this body, mind, sense organs has to be seen as part and parcel of the whole Maya Upadhi. This body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes you a jiva, including the ahankara, all of your knowledges, all of your ignorance, anything that can be objectified, anything that exists within duality, all of that belongs to Ishvara. So every point of identification with the jiva upadhi needs to be given back to Ishvara and be recognized as part and parcel of this creation. Now, it's so easy, if I'm looking out at all of you, it's very easy and natural for me to see all of you as part of the scenery. You are part of this creation, and that's obvious to me. It's my experience, because I experience you out of all five sense organs. And I see you as an interconnected part of this scene, of this situation. But somehow it's different for me to put myself into the scene. The subject who is looking at the scene that I'm experiencing all of you, it's harder for me to recognize that at the same time that I'm experiencing all of you, I'm experiencing this physical body through the same five sense organs. I'm experiencing my sense organs with my mind. I'm also experiencing every vritti, every thought and emotion that I have in my mind, that sakshibhasya, all of it is illumined, all of it is known. And so, in fact, every part of this upadhi, every level of this upadhi, belongs also to this scene. So we start with that, but then we need to recognize, and this is where I was trying to kind of to go with the meditation, we have to take it further than that. And it's not just this body is both that I am both the subject and the object. I am both this body and that body. I am all of the activity. I am the whole thing. I am the walking and I am the talking. I am the actions. I am the action that I do, and I am also the result of the action that is affecting you. Right? So I'm both the actor, the action, and the acted upon. I'm both the karma and the karmapala. Right? That's why I was using the dream analogy, because you're not just the actor, you're the actor, the action, and you're the result. Right? You're the entirety of it. And so, because if you can think of the dream, you can see how there is nothing that is not interconnected and nothing that is away from Ishvara. Right? And you are the self of that whole. So you're the self of the subject, the self of the object. You're the self of the arm that's throwing the ball. Right? You're the self of the one who's making the offering. You know, you're the offering itself. There's nothing in that creation or that experience that is not you. Okay, so now, say you start to appreciate that interconnectedness of all things that you're experiencing and your self being equally the self of every part of it. Right? So, I'm equally the self of this upadhi and equally the self of this table. And equally the self of the space and equally yourself. Because from the standpoint of the self, there's no division. The entire manifestation enjoys the one non-dual me. And it enjoys it equally. And so what becomes so helpful with this is not in times of happiness. Because in times of happiness, we're all like nyanis. In a way, you know, as long as you're not thinking about the temporary nature of it. If you can put that little thing out to the side for the moment, you know. But when things are going well, right, we don't have to work so much on our mind. And even for somebody who's a mumukshu or somebody who has jnanam but their knowledge is still maturing, you don't have to work so much on your mind when everything is fine. It's when things are not fine, you know, that kind of being able to bring in a certain understanding, a certain reality becomes really, really important. You know, like for instance, I talked a little bit about this on Thursday, but Swamiji did quite a bit on this from some of the tapes I was listening to when I was in India, so that's why I'm kind of bringing this because I found it useful. When something is not going well, when you are in a situation where there's dislike or adversity or hatred or anger or any of these isolating feelings that are so difficult to be with, you know, the feelings that are difficult to be with, it's in those situations where it's helpful to realize that this pain or agitation that's being generated, right, that you happen to be experiencing, actually is a karmapala that you're not all the solely involved in. It's not just you. Right? You're experiencing this pain or this agitation as a karma pola. You know, that means like a result of an action, which is complex. It's not just one thing that has happened that has created this painful situation. It's a network of things. It's a network of cause and effect. This has happened and that happened to this person, that happened to this person, this happened to this person, this happened to this person, and before this, that happened and that happened and that happened and that happened. There's a huge network that's involved in the production of this particular karmapala that many people are going to be experiencing, not just you. That's another thing that's so interesting to understand is sometimes when we're feeling in pain because of the actions of another, you know, it becomes helpful when you kind of objectify it like that and you realize that the pain you're experiencing, that other is experiencing the counterpart of that pain. You're not alone in that pain. It's shared. It's a group karmapala. It can be made of two people or three people or four people or five people. It's not just one person. So your pain is also their pain. Your wound is also their wound. They're just the other side of it. Right? And that phenomena has taken place because of karma. And I'm not talking about past life karma. That can be true too. Can also be a lot of past life stuff coming in. But I'm just talking about the present. Also, past life is another thing that's also useful to bring in sometimes. One of my friends, I remember when at an airport, someone was giving him a terrible time. And when he left, he said, "Om Bhagavan, I'm sorry for whatever I did to you in the last life." Because he had no relationship with this person in this life to be abused in this way. There was no reason for it whatsoever. He had done absolutely nothing to provoke him. The guy was just being that way. So, whatever I did, please forgive me. I'm very sorry. So that becomes useful too. But what I'm saying is that there's much more involved in terms of your feelings. If you're feeling something, don't think that the other person involved is not also feeling. There's two people involved, or three people involved. There's a network going on there. And so to be able to kind of understand that there are laws at work, and to try to see, to kind of understand those laws, and adjust your behavior in such a way, you know, that you can release yourself from that karma. Do you understand what I mean? It's like if you're suffering, if there's some suffering going on, the first thing to do that's so helpful is to objectify the situation, put yourself in it, and see the huge network of karmapala that's being generated there and how many things are involved in it. It's usually very complicated. It's not just one thing. And then objectify it and accept that, okay, that's Ishwara. This is Ishwara. These results, these feelings, these reactions, these situations are a product. They're a product, right? And I have been involved in the generation of this product. So, boom, I accept that. No? That accepting of it and seeing it as something that's bigger than yourself, that itself is a big relief. It's a relief, you know? And then experimenting with ways of being in that situation that can release you and release the situation from that pain. Because now you've objectified it. So all of this type of manana, it's a type of nididhyasana, it's a type of bringing your knowledge to play, you know, on the situation. Helpful for resolving the jivatvam into the creation. Seeing everything about yourself, all of your moods, all of your reactions, all of your joys and all of your suffering also, as being part and parcel of Ishwara, and having a certain order So trying to appreciate the order of that, and somehow that can be a great relief.
Mm.
And so that vision, that type of vision, is directly related to this. For the jnani is the one who really sees the whole and everything in your experience as Bhagavan, as Ishwar, is just being a manifestation of yourself. Even in terms of the prarabdha karma, this, as a jiva, this little bit of the creation that you get to experience, the whole of it that you experience with the prarabdha karma that caused you to take this birth, right, is itself interconnected. Just that we're all in this room, we're all interconnected. There's no way on earth that we could be together. It's because we're interconnected. Our karmas are interconnected. And so your very prarabdha karma involves the prarabdha karma of so many other people, or they can't come into your sphere. And so in a sense, your life, your prarabdha karma is being shared in different instances with so many other people. And so it's not that just this body and mind and sense organs and set of experiences are in my karma. All of yours are too, in this particular setting, or in my ongoing relationship, and our ongoing relationship with each other. Right? It's not just my feelings that are involved, your feelings that are involved. It's not just my life, it's your life. It's the interconnectedness, you know? And so all of it is there nicely unfolding, and the unfolding of your prarabdha is not just the unfolding of your body, the growing old of your body, it's the unfolding of your very life. And so when you think about the positive and negative situations that you are experiencing, the punya and the papa, say if we say this life, which they say in India so much, this very life is 50% punya, 50% papa. It means there's plenty of experiences that are not meant to make you happy. They're stressful. There's many stressful situations. And there's a lot of situations also that are not stressful, where you can relax and just be yourself. So we don't mind those. Those are no problem. I didn't notice them. Right? Because they don't conflict with my being. Right? They don't take me away from my own swarupa, my own nature. But the ones that are stressful, then I think, oh, this is my papa. You know? This is what's happening to me. But actually, that's true. It is happening to you, but it's the whole thing. It's happening to the entire situation. It's a papa. It's a group papa. You see what I mean? Like, say somebody is causing you a lot of pain. Now, there's a bad situation. Somebody is causing you a lot of pain. I guarantee that you're causing them a lot of pain too. The situation is the papa. And everybody who's involved in it is sharing that papa. We're all in the papa together. We're all kind of suffering together.
Yeah. Same for the punya.
And same for the punya. We're all sharing that together also. So it's interesting that instead of pulling yourself out as the victim, you know, to really recognize that there's a kind of a more interconnected a relationship going there with a lot of feelings, and a lot of feelings. When we talk about papa, we're usually talking about feelings. Otherwise, you're not suffering, so it's not a papa. For jnani, they can say, actually, Bhagavan can give all of these difficult situations, but I need not suffer. Right? I need not suffer. But to not suffer, you really have to have knowledge, because the creation is meant to make you suffer in that situation. So to not suffer, it means that you have to just see everything as Ishwara. Okay, this is Ishwara's problem here. This is what's going on. I accept that. And my mind just abides with myself and doesn't get entangled in that in the suffering of that situation. See what I mean? Situation is a suffering situation. Your mind doesn't engage with it. But the situation is a difficult situation. You know, for no matter how great of a Mahatma you are, say somebody like Swamiji who's so full in his knowledge, you can never say about Swamiji that he hasn't had a many, many, many very trying, very, very difficult situations. Very difficult. It's just, how does he engage in that situation? But everybody, including him, would know this is a difficult situation. This is a difficult situation to handle. So it's not that for a jnani, because that they don't know that a situation is difficult. You know, they know very well it's a difficult situation. But then, how to engage objectively in that situation? And somebody who has a lot of maturity in their knowledge is able to engage in it objectively. That's the trick. It's to be able to engage in it objectively. But to be able to engage in it objectively, then you yourself have to have some inner freedom, some inner space from the situation. And these are, I think, this type of meditation and this being able to see all of your situations really as part of Ishwara's order, even your emotions. Or Swamiji's spending a lot of time on that now, is just to help you get that, help all of us get that distance, you know, so that we can then objectively deal with the situation rather than being victimized by it. So here, now in these previous verses, all of the verses have been focused on the vision of the jnani, and now this Brahmarpanam, which we chant all of the time, is kind of culminates that vision, where the jnani is somebody who's able to see everything, including all of your action, all of the katakas. Katakas are all of the vibhaktis, the cases, the way that the different ways of relating to the verb. These are all called katakas, right? Like the subject and the object and the instrument and the ablative case and the locative case, all of these things. All of these ways of relating to the verb, the subject and the object and the instrument, etc. All of these things are Brahman alone. The way to really appreciate this, why I think the dream example is so profound, is because you can easily see when you imagine a dream that there is no part of that dream that is any less yourself. Right? It's not like it's not that the individual body that you assume in the dream is more you than the blade of grass. They're all absolutely one self, and one self equally. One doesn't, not one part of that creation has a, monopoly or more ownership of the nature of the self than another. It's all absolutely equal, absolutely one self. And so this verse is in honor of that. But now, Krishna now thinks, well, there are many, this is how a jnani in doing a ritual or a yajna, the jnani is going to see everything as Brahman. Right? But then there are many ways of doing a yajna. So let's look at some of these, doing a ritual, doing a different types of yajna can be done. So, daivam meva pare yajnam, daivam meva pare yajnam, yoginah paryupasate, yoginah paryupasate, brahmagna vapare yajnam, brahmagna vapare yajnam, yajne naivo pajuhuti, yajne naivo pajuhuti. Daivam eva apare yajnam yoginaha paryupasate. Brahma agnau apare yajnam yajnena eva upajuhuti. Says, daivam eva apare, apare yoginaha, other yogis, and here we're talking about karma yogis. This whole section is really dealing with the karma yogis and the jnanis, the mumukta, the sannyasis, the karma yogis and the sannyasis, all of whom are mumukshus. And so all mumukshus really are, but those who are mumukshus, the karma yogis, are doing their actions as a yajna, in the context of this chapter. They're all doing their actions as a yajna, means for the sake of Ishwara, for Ishwara's grace. And for Ishwara's grace means what are they asking for is really antakarma shuddhi. Okay? So even the karma yogis, those who have not recognized that both the subject and object are Brahman, right, they still have an ahankar, doing karma yoga in order to reduce that ahankar as they're being exposed to knowledge. Okay? And then there's the sannyasi also, who can be doing karma yoga also, but who does not yet have knowledge, right? But they're living a sannyasi life. Or the karma yogi who's living in the world, doing karmas, but all, whether you're a sannyasi without jnana nishtha, living the life of a sannyasi, or you're a karma yogi doing karmas in the world, all of them are done for the sake of the Ishwara anugraha, the grace of Ishwara. So for, and the grace of Ishwara means what are you seeking? It's a mumukshu. Is antakarma shuddhi. So all of these actions I do for the sake of yajna, means for the sake of Ishwara, I'm asking for antakarma shuddhi, for purity of mind. So here it says, apare yogina, others who are yogis, the karma yogis, who are doing, still have the kartritvam, who still have that sense of doership, but they're mumukshus and in the process of gaining knowledge. Those people, apare, others who are yogis, Parayupasate, they do the upasana, they make the offering, they do the yajna, they offer the yajna. The what type of yajna? Daivam. Yajna which is for the sake of the Lord. In other words, they do the yajna for the sake of the Lord, or they do it for other deities like for Ganesha, for Rama, or for Shiva. Whatever their Ishtadevata is, they do the yajna for the sake of the Lord, in order to get the Lord's blessing. So daivam means for the sake of the Lord, right? And the Lord can be Ishwara, or it can be any Ishtadevata. And so some yogis will do a yajna for that. But then others, Brahma agnau, apare, others, yajnam yajnena eva upajuhati. Others, the jnanis, so those are the karma yogis, now the jnanis. The jnanis, they do their offering, they offer the yajnam. Here yajnam means self. Their offering is the yajna itself, by the yajna. So according to the Bhasha, they offer themselves, they offer the self, the atma, by the self, by means of the self, brahmagnam, into the fire which is Brahman. And so for the jnani, the one who has this knowledge, is gaining this knowledge, their yajna is through knowledge, the offering of the ahankara, really, right, the atma into Brahman. So when I offer myself into Brahman, what am I doing is recognizing that the self, the atma, is Brahman. And so for the jnani, for the karma yogi, their offering will be to Ishwara, to the Lord, right, for antakarma shuddhi. For the sannyasi, or the jnani, the offering is of the self to Brahman. See the difference? One, the kartritvam is there, and so all of my actions become a yajna, an offering for the sake of everything I do is an offering as a yajna for the sake of the Lord. It means for Ishwara Nugraha, for antakarma shuddhi. But for the jnani, for the other, the sannyasi, who has jnanam, the offering is the offering of the atma, of the self, into the fire, which is Brahman. Right? So it says, Brahma agnau apare. Apare means others. Into the fire, which is Brahman. Yajnam, the yajna. They offer the yajna. Upajuhati. That they offer the yajna by the yajna alone. And here, according to Shankara, how you take yajna there is self. They offer the self by means of the self. Right? So, there they're talking just about the jnani. So let's go on. There's a whole list of these. Shrotradinindriyanyanye samyamagni shijuhvati shabdadindishyananye Indriyagni shijuhvati Shrotradini Indriyani Anye Samyama Agni shijuhvati Shabdadini Vishyan Anye Shabdadin Vishyan Anye Indriya Agnishu Juhuti Anye. Others Juhuti. Others offer Shrotradini Indriyani. All of the sense organs, beginning with the ears. Ears, eyes, sense of touch, sense of taste, sense of smell, all the five sense organs. Some others, mumukshus, they offer all of the sense organs into the fire of samyama. Samyama means the control. They offer all of the sense organs, beginning with ears, into the samyama, into the meditative discipline of resolving the sense organs into the self. So they're they offer all of their sense organs, it's shama. They offer all of their sense organs into that self-control, into the yajna of self, into the fire of self-control. Then others, shabdadin vishyan anye, indriyagnishu juhuti. Others, they offer the sense objects themselves, the sense objects, like the sense objects for the sense of hearing would be sound. So sound, things, objects of sight, form, objects of touch, objects of smell, all of the five sense objects. They offer these five sense objects into the sense organs, into the fire of the sense organs, which means what they're talking about here is dhamma, the ability to control, right? What you're going to offer, if you're going to offer something to your sense organs, that means that there's a conscious decision. If you offer something to the sense organs as though you offer it to the Lord, right? Because as in the spirit of yajna, you're offering these sense objects to the sense organs as though offering to the Lord. Then that act of offering also is an act of discipline. In other words, you don't want to make the Lord drunk, or stoned, or fat, etc. In other words, you become very conscious about it, the act of what you're feeding yourself, that what input you're giving to yourself, you're giving in the sense of yajna, you're actually giving to the Lord. And so there's a consciousness around how you are imbibing the sense organs. Whereas the one before that, the line before that, the sense organs themselves are being offered to that meditation, actually, to that control, sense of control, samyama, to concentration and contemplation and nididhyasana. Sense organs themselves are being offered. Whereas here, the second one, the sense objects, and one doesn't negate the other either, because a person has to live. So when you're dealing with the world, all of the input that you're taking in, you know, the input that you're taking in, or bhoga, the things that you're taking in to enjoy, all of those should be things that are being given to Ishwara. And so then there's also a discipline and a control there. Yajna, it always involves an offering to the Lord, and it always involves some sort of spiritual consciousness or spiritual discipline. In other words, you're doing this act, that's what makes it a yajna. You're doing this act as an offering to the Lord, as a prayer for the Lord. That's what makes it a yajna. And so for a mumukshu, these are the different ways that a mumukshu will go about doing this. And they're just different standpoints, you know, in terms of your relationship with God. And all of these things bring about a certain self-discipline and self-control, which helps bring about the antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. Because your mind, you know, in Krishna, Arjuna will say, you know, later, you know, the mind is like a ship at sea, you know, that's just being blown all around. You know, how to bring it in? Krishna talks so much about it. The mind is, you know, wild. Like that. It's wild. And so how to bring it in? And these different forms of yajna, you know, are ways of bringing that mind in. So the mind becomes something held and contained. It's brought in through your relationship with Ishwara. So these are different ways of doing that yajna that bring the mind into a state of peace. So, let's do this next one.
Sarvanindriya karmani, prana karmani chapare,
atma samyam, samyama yoga agnau,
jihvati jnana dipite.
Swamiji, when he's writing on this, he says this one is by a sannyasi who is not a jnani. Sarvani, he has a very nice commentary on these things. I hope you're all able to read that in this Gita Home Study. So, Sarvani Indriya Karmani, all of the actions of the indriyas. Here, Indriya Karmas here means the acts. All of the actions of the sense organs. That's the organs of action as well as the sensory organs. So, the actions of all of the indriyas, karma indriyas and jnana indriyas. Okay? And prana karmani, and the actions of all the prana, the vital force. You know, your ingoing and outgoing breath, your digestion, your circulation, your peristaltic movement, all of the things that make up the vital force, all of the prana, all the actions of all the prana and of all of the indriyas, all of these, apare, others, atma samyama yoga agnau, juhvati, apare juhvati, others offer into the fire of the of that atma samyama yoga. Into the fire of that yoga, which involves again the contemplation on the Atma. Atma Samyama Yoga Agnau. Jnana Dipite. Lit up that Atma Samyama, which is lit up by jnana, by knowledge. Okay. So all of these are offered into all of my sense organs, my organs of action, all of my prana, my entire life, really. Everything that makes me a jiva, the whole thing is offered up into my contemplation upon the Atma, upon the Self. And that contemplation is lit up, it's nididhyasana, right? That contemplation is lit up by my knowledge. And that offering is jnana dipita. Dipita means lit up. That contemplation is lit up by my knowledge. And so this is for a jnani who is now doing nididhyasana in order to recognize the nature of the self, to own up the nature of the self. So Swamiji took that. Let's do this next one. Dravya jnyas tapo jnyaha, dravya jnyas tapo jnyaha, yoga jnyas tatapare, yoga jnyas tatapare, swajaya jnana jnyas cha. Swadhyaya jnana yajnyascha yatiyasam samshita vrataha. Says, there are dravya yajnyaha, yajnas which people do using dravya, means using material. In other words, so much, we're usually talking about all of the different charities where your wealth is being dispersed in some way or another. These are gift-giving, charities, dispersing of wealth. This is a kind of a well-known type of yajna, you know, where you're giving, that act of giving is done for the sake of antakarana shuddhi, or for the grace of the Lord. So that's called dravya yajna. Tapo yajna, yajnas that involve tapas. Tapas means austerities, you know, like an austerity, some austerities, like a person who decides as a tapas to fast every Monday, or fast on the 14th day of the new moon, that type of thing. So any type of an austerity that you're doing for the sake of Ishvara, for the grace of the Lord, for the sake of antakarana shuddhi, as a prayer, any type of austerity that you practice, any type of discipline, that tapas, that's a type of yajna that they call tapo yajna. Then yoga yajnaha. Yoga yajna, Here, when Swamiji was talking about this, he was talking mostly about pranayama and the Ashtanga yoga, all of the yogic practices, pranayama, you know, yama niyama, pratyahara, that, all of them, the asana, pranayama, pratyahara, all of these things, all of the Ashtanga yoga, the yogic practices, that can also be done for the sake of yajna. If it's not done for the sake of yajna, then you're doing it for what? For the sake of your health, or for the sake of some sort of experience. But if you're doing it for yajna, means you're doing it for antakaran shuddhi. You're doing it for Ishwara anugraha, means for the grace of the Lord. That's why you're doing this. You're doing the yoga in order to achieve the antakaran shuddhi that can allow you to gain knowledge. And so it becomes a prayer, right? It becomes a discipline which you're undertaking for the grace of the Lord to help you to gain antakaran shuddhi. Now, swadhyaya jnana yajnascha. Swadhyaya is also a yajna, and that's for people who are studying the first part of the Vedas. There's a swadhyaya, means there's a certain a ritual, a prescribed way, according to viddhi, according to prescription, that the Vedas are read and studied and learnt and chanted. And that's called swadhyaya, where the Vedas are read and memorized and learned every day according to particular prescriptions. That's swadhyaya. The jnana yajna means the study of the Vedas for their meanings. That's really talking usually about the Upanishads here, the jnana yajna, where you're not repeating the Vedas, learning how to chant them and repeating them in a particular way. Instead, you're studying them to understand their meaning. So swadhyaya is one type of yajna. Jnana yajna is another, where you're reading and studying the Vedas, the Upanishads, in order to know them, to understand them in terms of meaning. Mm-hmm. Then yatayaha. Then there are the sages, the ascetics. Their type of yajna is samshita vrataha. The yetis, the ascetics, will take severe vows, vratas. Mean severe, difficult vows. And they will devote themselves to fulfilling those type of austerities. Those are the ascetics. Those are also done for the sake of antakarana shuddhi, for Ishwara anugraha, that will, for the prayer of that, resulting in moksha, in liberation. So all of these are so many different types of yajnas. We'll stop there because there's too many more. I want to kind of get through a few of them, but no. That's all right. We'll get through next time. Okay, let's just take a minute.
Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Which was when you said he's offering the Atma to Brahman. So is that like a sense of being a separate?
Yeah, it's the offering of the self to Brahman. So the jiva, you know, with the ahankara, takes the Atma to be separate from Brahman. So that resolution of the Atma as Brahman. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's interesting as we go through these also, because he does a couple of more verses, even giving some more. But really, it's just looking at it, there
more
are
more rituals,
more different ways of doing this type of yajna. In other words, there's so many different ways, say as a mumukshu or as a karma yogi, there's so many ways that your life can be related to Ishwara. You know, where every action that you do has a relationship to Ishwara. And that's what they're just, there's so many different ways to do that. And in the end, the one that is going to be Shreyas, the yajna that will be Shreyas or exalted, or the one that swallows all the others, is jnana, is knowledge. Right, so that's how it's going to conclude. But he's using all of these also because for the karma yogi, and until the jnana nishta is there, the mind is at peace. As long as the creation is able to pull your mind out into it and, you know, make you a victim, victimize you. And as long as it's capable of doing that, then these type of disciplines or attitudes are very, very helpful, mm-hmm. because they bring a certain level of consciousness mm-hmm. to your relationship with the world. Like your relationship to your sense organs, the sense organs relate. Next verse he'll do, he's going to be talking about prana, the ingoing and outgoing breath for those who practice pranayama. There's so many different ways. These are just a few. If he can give 6, he can give 100. You know, it's not like these are an inclusive group. It amounts to everything should be done for Ishwara Anugraha, for the grace of the Lord, for the sake of the Lord. So that means everything that you do is a recognition of Ishwara. The only difference between the karma yogi and the jnani is that the karma yogi still has that sense of ahankara, that sense of I am the karta, I am the doer who is worshipping and doing everything for the sake of the Lord. As for the jnani, the karta gets thrown into as being part of Ishwara. So the whole thing, the karta and the karma, the doer and the doing, and all of it becomes Ishwara. All of it is Ishwara. All of it is Brahma. So that's that. That is the difference. But the one, there's a very there's not much distance from the one to the other. You know, in other words, in terms of attitude, if everything I do is for the sake of Ishwara, there's only just the little difference of having to throw myself in there, right? But in terms of attitude, in terms of attitude, in terms of antakarana shuddhi, in terms of shanti, mm-hmm. that shanti is the same. And close to the same. And Krishna actually comes out and says, you know, the shanti of the karma yogi is equal to the shanti of the jnani. We'll get to that first. Because attitude.
But doesn't the karma yogi shanti involve a lot more faith, and the shanti of the jnani, you know, the faith is almost...
Well, the shraddha resolves into knowledge for both the karma yogi and the sannyasi. But you have to always remember that in the context of the Gita, the karma yogi and the sannyasi are both mumukshus, and both are doing shravana manana nididhyasana. So the knowledge is not away from either one, right? But then there's a process that's involved when the teaching is occurring. There's some takes some time, right? In order for a person to really get it, to really see it, to own it, to understand it. You know, and so the whole Bhagavad Gita, really, Krishna is saying over and over, until that antakarana shuddhi is there and your mind enjoys shanti, no matter where you are, you should be in the world. Don't take the sannyasa. Because if you're taking sannyasa, his idea is this: you're limiting your possibilities for being able to gain that antakarana shuddhi. You're putting yourself in a very restricted environment in terms of your experience, because a lot of the experiences, at least in sannyasa in India, a lot of the experiences are denied you at that time. Once you take sannyasa, then your life really is a life of teaching and contemplation, and, you know, and so you've withdrawn from the world, so it's better to stay in your situation until your situation doesn't bother you. Until you're yeah, because otherwise you get out of your situation, but the part of you that was bothered is still there in your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you go back into the situation,
you get bothered
again.
I stumble a little bit about this. I do everything for the sake of the Lord. Could you...
Well, what we mean by that, what you do it for the sake of the Lord, for Ishwara Anugraha, we say the grace of the Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, first, a couple of things are involved there. First of all, I recognize everything as Ishwara. I recognize this as a manifestation of Ishwara. That nothing, that everything I do really is in relationship to Ishwara. But then, what am I really praying for? Because everybody who's doing this in reference to the Gita here is a mumukshu. And so what you want is moksha. And for moksha, you need Ishwara's grace. What do you need Ishwara's grace for if you've got the teacher and the teaching is there? For antakarna shuddhi. For a mind that enjoys that enough shanti, you know, to be able to gain this knowledge and to be able to hold this knowledge.
Well, why can't we say that I do this for the sake of my peace?
I think... You can say that, but part of it is to try to get you to recognize your interrelatedness with the whole.
Okay.
So the body-mind sense organs, this individual here is not just a soul entity in an inert creation.
Okay.
That this body-mind sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara. It is,
so
in fact, it is Ishwara.
Both should be there for my own peace and also recognizing that I am not just a separate individual from the whole.
That recognition that you are not separate from the whole, that you, in fact, that this is Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
As much as this and this and this is Ishwara, this is Ishwara. These thoughts are Ishwara, the emotions are Ishwara, the whole is Ishwara. Right? That recognition is necessary for Shanti.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because otherwise your knowledge, right, is conditional. Right? Your Shanti is conditional. Right, I need things to be in a particular way in order for me to be happy, even though I know that it's all Ishwara, still I need
it.
Yeah.
And one last little thing. What if you have like a little depression or something like that? How do you see that as part of the whole, or not becoming an individualized person?
Well, you know, that's what I mean by, say if a physical situation takes place. Maybe in some ways, because if this physical situation has taken place, it is a fact. It is a fact, and it is something that is capable of happening because it has happened, right? And so it belongs to the creation. It is accounted for in the order of the creation, in Ishwara's order, because it has happened, right? So that is part of Ishwara, and the laws will allow this event to happen. And then you can objectify it and see all of the interrelatedness and all of the cause and effect that actually went in, the complexities that went into actually creating this situation, if you get some distance on it, and you can see, you know, the complexities that were involved in actually allowing this, the birth of this karma pala, which is what it is. It's a result of an action. The emotional life is the same. There are complexities of cause and effect that go into not just producing the physical situation, but the emotional situation. That's why we can have psychology. You know, that's why we can relate to each other's emotions and feelings. We can tell by a glance if a person is angry or down or depressed or hurt or whatever. We can see it. We can feel it, in fact, right? Other people's emotions. And we can empathize, we can understand, we can know what type of things cause that. And when you say, this is what happened to me, and this, and this, oh, that's why you're feeling so down, you know?
Well,
so what I'm saying is that the emotions themselves, including depression and anger and agitation and hatred, even the worst of them and the best of them, all of those emotions also are karma pala. They all have some reason. They have something in the complexity of the situation. It can even be physical, because sometimes physical, chemical problems are responsible for our moods and emotions. But there is something that has gone into generating that. And so all of those things, many of them are much more than you.
So,
you see what I mean? So
yeah, but then saying that I'm responsible for that. I mean, there's a responsibility. I'm responsible for the anger, or I'm responsible for the depression. That mood takes place. You're saying that that's not valid.
Well, I say it's small-minded.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would say like this. There is a mood. It is your mood, so you are going to have maybe the most ability to affect that mood.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's your mood.
Yeah.
Right, so you're closest to it, to be able to affect it and to change it, perhaps. But what has gone into generating that mood,
mm-hmm.
you're involved in that, and all of these other things are involved in it, and going, you know, back layer upon layer upon layer, there's a lot involved in the generation of that mood that has to do with you and others in the situation, and on and on and on and on. And so you can say that this particular mood is a result of myself and others and a lot of different karma that I'm now experiencing. And what and you see that as part of Ishvara's order. That what has produced that mood has to do with you and a lot of other things also. Right? That's why if you objectify the mood and take it a little bit outside of just you, your little container there.
Yeah, the feeling that I have ownership to this, you know?
Well, you have ownership to it more than other people because you're experiencing it, right? But seeing it as part of Ishvara and seeing all of the different things that go into the generation of it, and then letting it belong to Ishvara, say okay, no, it is Ishvara anyway. There isn't anything that isn't Ishvara, right? At all.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, and so, but since that is taking place within your upadhi, if we're talking about mood, you're in a position to work with it. But that doesn't mean that that one who's working with it is not also part of Ishvara. That's also available to you, right?
But that sense of objectivity can even be, you know, felt by a person who is not spiritual. But that sense of objectivity can be, you know, even if you don't call it Ishvara.
That's right.
You know, you just... Yeah. Not in spiritual terms, but just it seems to some degree common.
Yeah, it's not, that's right. It's not just, you might not call it Ishvara,
right.
But that doesn't mean you don't have the capacity to
objectify
right. your situation.
Right.
And in fact, in psychology, that ability to objectify your situation is called, in some sense, it's called the observing ego. It means are you able to objectify your emotions and to objectify the things that are occurring so that you have some space. A person who's not able to do any of that objectification has a very difficult time. It's a more of a borderline structure where there is no ability to have that distance between your experiences and your emotions and to objectify yourself side by side with the other. You know, that allows for empathy and so many other things. Yeah. But for the jnani, it's going a little bit beyond the objectification in that you see all of this as Ishvara, that all is enjoying one being, which is myself. You know,
yeah.
So that adds something.
Right, right.
It seems that most of the, what is ordinarily, you know, emotions around anger, fear, sense of separateness,
isolation,
and they seem to be generated often by a sense of self-preservation, and a sense that, and that need for self-preservation, which is, it's like it's self-generated isolation because somehow one feels harmed or threatened or.
Yeah, it's all to do with that. Yeah. All of the feelings,
mortality.
Or, you know, that sense of separateness or that sense of isolation or all is not well with me. Whenever that all is not well with me label comes, then I have to do something.
So I was going to ask, very, very often in relation, one of the practices, I don't know if it's going to get into that, but one of the practices to contemplate one's death is a form of spiritual practice, to contemplate one's mortality. So is that an exercise that helps generate a sense of space around?
You know, I mean, a contemplation, we could do a contemplation like that, but it has to be in the context of knowledge.
Yeah.
So why would a person do that type of contemplation? Mm-hmm. It would have to do with objectifying the body and the sense organs, and, you know, you could do some, we don't really do contemplations like that, but you could do a contemplation like that, but it would have to be contextualized properly. Just to contemplate, like Ramana, he's the one who was usually thought of that. He contemplated on his death when he was a young boy, tried to imagine what that was like, what that would be like to be dead. You know, and he had some profound insights from doing that. And so maybe in Ramana's lineage, people will all try to lay back and contemplate on being dead so that they can have the same insight.
We can do that next week.
Well, Ramana had, you know, Ramana had.
But, we'll all lay on the floor.
Yeah, but when you read his story,
yeah,
it's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
But I can see that people who are within that line, that might be something that they would do because their teacher did that. You know what I mean? But then, say, if he were to teach that, he would probably add a little something here and there. Yeah. But, yeah.
Question. It's kind of not related to this evening's talk, but I'm working with this lady who has dementia, you know, and a lot of stuff comes up for me, you know, around, my God, I'm going to end up like that, because there's a tremendous amount of suffering in there, you know, the way she lives. And the question I have is like, if one has enough knowledge, then the mind will in effect the consciousness, right? Because
well, this is interesting. Nothing will affect the consciousness.
Right.
No matter how demented you are, or even if you're in coma, doesn't make any difference. You're the being, the me-ness. It has nothing to do with the mind. The mind doesn't add to your sense of self. The mind adds thoughts, logic, emotions, feelings, memories, all of these type of things. But all of these things belong to Maya. They are not intrinsic to the self, right? And so she may not be able to be relating to you, and her mind may be wacky and doing this and that and the other thing, but her sense of self is the same as it was when her mind was completely okay, and the same as when she was a child. Or in past lifetimes, it's unwavering. Mm. The mind, however, depending upon her situation and what she went into the dementia with, is going to be relatively uncontrolled, right? Because when the mind is harmed, and the brain is harmed in that way, then it's throwing up all different kinds of thoughts and kind of random, for as far as we know, types of associations and things, and the person is living in that environment. And that is what it is. I don't know how, to what degree Bhagavan protects.
My question is, it's like, you know, so I will be studying the knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one day I get dementia. So would I still be able to objectify the mind, knowing who I am?
It depends on what if the buddhi is taken out, you know, then you're just going to have, if the buddhi is taken out, or that part of the brain, then the mind is just going to be doing whatever it does. You know, so depending on, I would say like this, depending upon the assimilation of your knowledge and the type of thoughts that are actually there rotating in the brain, you know, they can still be rotating around your being. Like for a jnani, you don't really need a thought to tell you who you are. You are already that once the ajnanam is removed. But if the mind is compromised, and say it doesn't, there's no buddhi there, there's just thoughts that are flowing up, there's no agent in the mind, then all that's happening is that your being is there and the thoughts are just being experienced.
But so, again, you also have dementia or Alzheimer's or something, and then there's no problem and there's no solution, there's nothing, and there's what there is, right?
There's just what there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there, whatever that mind is, you know, say if the buddhi is gone, there's no kartha there, there's no ahankar, there's no even in seed form, there's no controlling agent there. Then there's just these thoughts that are taking place.
But I thought liberation was for the mind. And if you lose the mind, then...
There's no problem. There's no
if the mind is there, and then the body drops, if their ajnanam is gone, then you're released from the brain, right? The subtle body is... The brain's the one that has dementia, not the subtle body.
Mm-hmm. Right? But I'm wondering if the question is, in a way... I'm not sure. But I'm wondering if the sort of question... For all of us would be like, well, does that mean even if you're a jnani that you in some sense would lose access to your knowledge in a way if you had dementia, because knowledge is for the mind, for the buddhi, and then, you know, would you kind of just be demented, but, you know, just almost like be an ordinary person, because you wouldn't have the type of mind that was capable of knowing, of recognizing.
You know, it's an interesting question. Again, it depends on what type of samskaras are there operating in the mind. Right? Because there's not going to be a buddhi there to be making cognitive judgments. And so there's just going to be... I mean, I'm talking as though I'm a dementia expert. But what I'm saying is there's just going to be the mind that is being experienced. And so that would be more kind of like a dream, for instance, or like a daydream where there's no kartha there, there's no buddhi there, making a commentary upon the experience. So there's only the experience.
So you were starting to say before, it's not the subtle body?
Yeah. The dementia, say if we look from a Vedantic perspective, where there's a physical body, physical brain.
Mm-hmm.
The physical brain is what gets dementia.
Mm-hmm.
The subtle body is now occupying a physical body that has a disturbed, a hurt brain, right? A brain that's suffering from dementia. When the subtle body is removed from that physical body, then the dementia, along with all the other ails of the body, are now gone. And now the subtle body, with whatever its karma is going to continue on. Now say, for that subtle body, right? Say jnanam has taken place.
Yeah.
Knowledge has taken place.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing to make that jiva become a jiva again. The jiva is basically gone. Even while living, the jiva is gone.
Oh, so you're saying that even if a jiva mukta has a mental disability, then they remain a jiva mukta?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. In
terms of their knowledge, when the body's gone, then that one who is already liberated is still liberated. But they're just living for a while in a body that doesn't operate. Like it's not working right.
So the knowledge is not just purely taking place at the physical level.
No.
Actually, you know, what is interesting about that is the point that I made years ago, that is, this is not really about knowledge, it's about the lack of confusion or the lack of delusion.
That's why they say knowledge, jnanam, is really called ajnana nivritti.
Exactly.
Knowledge is the removal of ignorance. It's not the gain of something. Mm-hmm. It's the removal of something. And in the removal of the ajnanam, the ignorance, you have the removal of the adhyasa. Right? So the ajnanam is responsible for the superimposition. When you remove the ajnanam, the superimposition can't remain. Right? But now say your physical brain has been hurt. It's not functioning anymore. It's not an instrument that you can use. But when you were able to use it, you were Jivanmukta, at that time knowledge took place, when you're released from the body could be also hurt and in coma. So many things can happen, you know. But when you're released from that body, then the liberated jiva that you were is still a liberated jiva.
But then, like, for somebody who has dementia, like we were talking about being objective, you know. I mean, so even if you were a jnani and you had dementia, but you kind of lose your objectivity. I mean, do you know what
it depends on the dementia. Like, if you lose your buddhi, there's nobody there. There's just thoughts, right? There's just experiences coming and going. There's nobody saying, oh, this is a good experience or this is a bad experience. There's just experience. Right? It depends on what has actually gone on with the person. Like, say the buddhi is still there and it's functional and they have dementia, but they still have a buddhi, then what will they be saying? My God, I've got dementia. You know, but that still, that viveka could still be there. It's there as long as it's the mechanism is there. But what if the mechanism's not there?
Yeah, that's actually what this person does. You know, she'll go like, she'll be like, I'm in jail. I want to get out of jail. She wants to jump out of the window. And then all of a sudden, you know, if I stay present with her and then, you know, without getting involved in the whole delusion, she'll go like, how did I ever get here? What happened?
No. Yeah. When my father was at Alzheimer's, I spent a lot of time with him actually, and he, most of the time when he was really had it very badly, he was really very much in his own world. It was an imaginary world. It wasn't so much of the time. It was really not related to reality. And at the same time, I had walked into the place where he was, he'd wave, say, that's my daughter, that's my daughter. He'd say, hi, Dad, run down. You know, but then when we would spend some time together, the world was very, very imaginary. Even his talking to me wasn't talking to me. He was talking to somebody. Either he was talking to me as my mother, or it was some other person, you know.
Was it happy or sad or a mix of whatever?
You know, it was... for the most of you, we get angry sometimes, but for the most part, it's kind of neutral.
Mm.
Yeah. And not neutral in a bad way, but just this is what it is.
Oh, it seems from what you were saying that if the person is already established, if he's a Jivanmukta, Alzheimer's is not going to make any difference. However, if the person is using the mind or is using jnana,
mm-hmm.
that is the means to try to achieve moksha, then someone with Alzheimer's, then it's problematic, then it's no longer accessible.
But, yeah, but even for the jnani, it might not be, there might not be anybody there to be making access. But you know, another thing way to look at it too is Krishna, Arjuna asked Krishna, what's going to happen to me if I get killed in battle? Because you've said all of this, it's clear, but I know I'm going to get totally overwhelmed when I'm in the middle of the battle. What will happen to my knowledge and to me? I don't have nishta, you know? So what will happen? And Krishna said, well, you'll either be born into the house of the yogis who have knowledge, means people already have this knowledge, and you'll get it at a young age, you'll pick up where you left off. Or if you have more karma to exhaust, you know, you'll be born into a dharmic family and then you'll be reunited with a teacher and you'll gain knowledge. And so that's another way of saying, you know, nothing is lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't have jnana nishta, when you die, even if you die a natural death, and you don't have that clarity of knowledge, you'll just be born and pick up the thread. Doesn't make any difference. You know, we've had beginningless lifetimes. And so if you have one more life or two more lives, who cares? It doesn't matter. You know,
so
you will pick up the thread.
It's
you know,
not immediately that you're innocent or guilty.
It'll finish when it finishes. You know, this process of maturation, like a flower, like Swamiji used the example of a rose blooming, you know, let it bloom. It will complete itself as it completes itself. And now you're at this place where you're gaining knowledge, you're gaining clarity, and you're watching your own self mature and develop. So just enjoy that process. And every day is better than the next, and every year is better than the year before, because your nishtha, your rootedness in this knowledge, is more and more and more. So you start to just kind of enjoy that that process, and not try to make yourself more mature than you are, but rather try to be with your mind in a kind way that allows it to naturally mature. You know? And if something goes wrong along the way and you get Alzheimer's, or if something happens, you know, whatever, you know, you'll, if you're already a Jivanmukta, when the body drops, you'll just be one with Brahman, as you already are. Or if there's still things to finish for your own maturation, your own, you know, need, own personal needs, you know, then you'll take the appropriate body.
So either way, you're still a winner then.
You're still fine.
All is well with me.
All is well.
That's cool. From a Vedantic standpoint, if you look at the physical, subtle, and the causal, and you said that, you know, if somebody has a mental disease, it's not, or the gyan nishtha remains in the subtle body. But when someone initially is in Akshu, the problem, you know, the questions that you have, or the problem that you have, that's in my brain, right? That's in my causal. Is that from a Vedantic standpoint, is that causal, or physical or subtle? The problem,
the brain, remember that the subtle body and the brain are united together, right?
Right.
Once it takes, and so the subtle body is very much there operative,
right,
in the physical brain.
Right.
So both are being affected.
Right.
Right. As you're gaining knowledge, the subtle body is also taking the knowledge that the brain is.
Okay,
but now, there's a difference here. In reference to all worldly knowledge, there's a subject-object relationship. Right? Even from the standpoint of the subtle body or the brain, if I'm gaining knowledge of something other than the Atma, I'm gaining knowledge of something that is not me from the standpoint of the jiva. Right? So there's a subject-object relationship. That object, since it is not me, can go away. I can forget about it. It can be, say if I die and take another birth, I don't have any relationship. There's nothing to hook me up with that object. Right? The Atma is different. The Atma, yourself, is the very self of the body, of the mind, of the karma. It's the truth of it, right? And that truth of your being is what has been appreciated. That ajnanam has been removed, and now yourself is free. The self that you recognize as yourself is free. It's Brahman, right? And that's the truth while you're living. When this body drops, that truth remains, because that ajnanam has been eliminated. You can't get it back. And you can't get the adhyasa back that caused. And so when this body drops, or the person is a jivanmukta and doesn't have some scars and things that have to, you know, to still point the mind out, then there's nothing to keep that mind attached, you know, to make it hook on to another, take another birth.
Even then, the mind would be gone, right? I mean, there wouldn't be no more mind.
There won't. No, it all of the upadis go back into their elements, at least that's how it's explained in the Upanishads and the Vedanta. Because there's nothing holding it. So you're just Ishwara. You're Ishwara anyway.
Yeah.
But now you're Ishwara without a jiva upadi.
Mm.
Ishwara, when you have a jiva upadi, then even though you're Ishwara, the jiva upadi is experiencing the world as a jiva through these eyes and sense organs and mind, because that's what the jiva has sense organs, has a mind, all of it reflects consciousness. And so this jiva is going to be experiencing the world.
So who's that?
The jiva?
Yeah, is that Ishwara?
The jiva is part and parcel of Ishwara. But the sense organs and the mind will reflect consciousness, and they give you that sense of personal identity.
Is that why they say, you know, the upadi, like, is the condition, because it conditions,
it's a condition.
In a sense, it conditions Ishwara? I mean, it's sort of as though, because, like, you're Ishwara already, but then having a a body that Ishwaratvam, it's conditioned.
Yeah, but think of it like this. Because Ishwara isn't conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
Ishwara is not conditioned because there's only from standpoint of Ishwara, there's only the identification with the sattva. And so the way to understand this is, say if you're having a lucid dream, while you're having that lucid dream, there's two things that can be happening simultaneously. First, your consciousness is with the whole. So you are the whole. The whole is known to you. And you can also be identified, you can take a body in that dream and be identified with that individual. And then when you're identified with that individual, you're experiencing the creation out of the sense organs of that individual. Okay. Now, say you were to totally objectify that individual, means withdraw from identification with that individual, which can happen in a dream, right? Then you're experiencing all of the jivas in the dream and the whole, right? You're Ishwara. Even though all of these jivas are there all going around saying, me, 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 I'm me, I'm me, I'm me. Still, from your perspective as Ishwara, you are the whole. That's what they call the abhimana. The point of identification is with myself as the whole. That's the Ishwara upadhi. Even though all of the jivas are there, and all of the jivas are bound by ignorance. And so what is the maya upadhi for Ishwara, the whole manifestation of maya, is for Ishwara, that becomes ajnanam for the jiva. Because the jiva's sense organs and mind are limited. You know, like they're waved to the ocean. They're part and part, they're just part of the whole. And so they're looking out through a mind and sense organs that are limited and experiencing the creation from within it, rather than being having an identity with the whole.
So the only way really to break that is to really understand while remaining in the body, is to understand that everything is Brahman, really.
Yeah. Oh, that everything is Ishwara. If you say everything is Ishwara, you're also saying everything is Brahman.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what if you have self-knowledge and you know that you're Brahman? What would you say about this experience of what I'm having now? I mean, I see and I feel and I talk.
I say that's a tremendous wonder.
Yeah.
For jnani, if you're a jnani, you're walking through yourself.
Yeah.
Right? This creation, this Ishwara, this whole Ishwara is your manifestation of manifest knowledge. And then you have this jiva upadhi, which is also Ishwara. So you recognize that this jiva upadhi, which is part and parcel of Ishwara, is walking through Ishwara, and the whole thing is a manifestation of yourself. That's kind of one of the wonders.
Yeah, because somebody's having this sense perception. I mean, I'm having a sense perception.
Your sense organs are, right, in your mind. But all of those belong to Ishwara. They're all part of the creation. And that's why when you object, you have to be able to objectify the room and then put your body and mind and sense organs in the room that you've objectified, because it is in the room.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I see you as an object and you see me as an object. Now I just have to see myself as an object.
Yeah, we
right?
can do that. Yeah.
Well,
that's kind of what happens when you look in the mirror or something. I have that. And it's just wondering, like, who's this? It's like, you know, it's like, it's the same thing like looking at somebody else and wondering,
right.
Who is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
like what you were just saying. You know,
it's me.
It's easy to see this body is you, but you have to see if you can see the other person is you.
Yeah.
Your see your emotions is you, but what about the other person? You know, especially when you're not getting along.
Oh yeah, let's do it then.
Especially when you loathe the other person.
It's easy to see them as you if you love.
Then it's easy.
It's emotional identification.
If you love the other person and they're loving you back, then it's okay. At that moment that you're loving them, at that very moment they're loving you back, then
that's right.
Wonderful.
That would be a better time to make an inquiry.
Yeah. Well, okay. Sounds good on Saturday for those. We're ready.